Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock and heavy metal. Two national radio shows, best-selling books, and host of That Metal Show on VH1 Classic. Now, Eddie's bringing his honest, no-nonsense approach and passion to the world of podcasting. You'll hear commentary, analysis, celebrity guests, and who knows what else. PodcastOne.com presents The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Eddie Trunk, and it's time for another Eddie Trunk Podcast. New every Thursday, PodcastOne.com, and on iTunes, just search for the Eddie Trunk Podcast, or do what I do and subscribe to it. It'll pop up every Thursday when it's uploaded, and you can just hit your download button, and you're good to go for the week. And yes, I do listen back to my own podcast from time to time, because a lot of times when I'm doing interviews with people, I miss sometimes. I'm so focused on what I'm doing and where I'm going next and steering the thing that sometimes I pick out little tidbits and things that I didn't even realize that they said. And that's always kind of fun to delve into. So I enjoy listening back and learning some things that maybe I forgot when I'm talking to the person the first time around. And many times it's probably the 30th or 50th or 100th time that I'm talking to some of these people. So it's always good to reacquaint myself with some of the things that they had to say. And last week we had a lot of fun. Hope you enjoyed that. Two good friends, Chris Jericho, Scott Ian, sitting in together. And a lot of great response to that. Scott's book is out there right now, I'm the Man, as is Jericho's. I have not had a chance to read either of them in their entirety. It's very difficult. As I was saying, everybody in the world is writing books these days. It's incredible to try to keep up with all the books that have been coming out. And unlike a CD or something where you can just pop it in, or any sort of music, and listen to it in the background or listen to it while you're driving, I mean, reading a book is a commitment. You need to really focus and block out distractions. And I find the only time I really get to read a book is on a plane, because there's no other thing you can be doing. I mean, yeah, I'm sure they have Wi-Fi on some planes, but I don't really do that. So it's kind of good to get that disconnect, if you will, and knock out a book on a long flight. And that's the thing I look forward to doing. So I'm about a quarter of the way through Scott Ian's book, and I still haven't read Jericho's latest. I also have Andrew Dice Clay's book, which I'm a huge fan of, and looking forward to reading that as well. And of course, we're now in the holiday season officially. How crazy has it gotten, the whole commercialization of the holidays? I mean, it's at new levels now. We're seeing Christmas commercials 3 weeks before Thanksgiving. And this whole doorbuster thing. didn't some people get killed busting through the door of a Walmart or something a few years ago to get, I don't know, a toaster for $5 cheaper, as if it's never going to be that price again? I mean, I don't know. That whole mentality bothers me. Maybe it's because I'm a guy that grew up working in retail. For years, I worked in a record store in New Jersey. And although it was certainly a lot of fun, if you worked retail in your life, or maybe you do work retail, the holidays are brutal, because unless you're the owner of the business where you're getting all the money from the spike in holiday traffic, if you're just the clerk and you're getting paid your flat rate, I mean, you're dealing with ridiculous hours. Some stores opening at 4 or 5 a.m., you know, staying open till 11 or midnight. Often you don't even get a chance to eat anything or take a break. It's nuts. And then you've got people buying into the whole doorbuster thing, you know, and literally running the door in the morning to get in for these sales. It's just madness. It's so ridiculous. And I remember all the years I worked retail. Thanksgiving is such a great holiday, and hope you guys all had a great one who are listening in the U.S. But the day after, if you work retail, is a bitch. The day they call Black Friday, because you have to usually, after coming off of Thanksgiving holiday, wake up at like 3 a.m. and get ready to log a dozen hours retail with just people just all over you. And it's brutal in the malls. It's brutal. And I, for the life of me, don't understand it. I don't understand why anybody would wake up at 3 a.m. on a Friday and fight crowds and fight traffic and fight malls. Do you really think you're never going to get that sale again? Is it really worth it? So my heart goes out every time this year to the people that work retail. Now, funny thing is, for the longest time, you hear that term Black Friday all the time, which we just passed. And a lot of times people didn't even know what Black Friday meant. I didn't. I'll never forget, as long as I live, I was a host on VH1 Classic for about 5 years prior to that metal show. A lot of people don't realize this because VH1 Classic was not as popular of a channel. But I started working there in 2002. And for 5 years, I did all genres of music. I hosted the alternative show, the soul show, the hard rock show, the 70s show, the rock show. I interviewed every genre of artist you could imagine. I interviewed Men at Work. I interviewed Gloria Gaynor. I interviewed Paul Weller. I interviewed John Mellencamp, Robert Plant twice. I did tons of interviews that all aired on VH1 Classic long before that metal show. And I will never forget doing an interview. We shot a Thanksgiving special 1 year. At this table having Thanksgiving dinner, and this aired on TV, was me, Dee Snider, Debbie Gibson, Daryl McDaniels from Run DMC, and Gloria Gaynor, the disco queen who had that huge song in the 70s, I Will Survive. And we went around this table, and it's one of my favorite stories I talk about all the time around the holidays, because I always get reminded of it. We go around this table, and I'm sitting right next to Miss Gloria Gaynor, and we're all having a Thanksgiving dinner. We're actually eating turkey and stuff. And they get to me. The question they went around the table with was, what does Thanksgiving mean to you? Like, what are your memories of Thanksgiving? And I said, well, for me, it's kind of a two-edged sword. Because on one hand, I think of family and eating and friends and the fun of it. And then on the other hand, having been a guy that worked in the retail world for so long, my next thought goes to having to work the next day and how brutal that is working in a mall on Black Friday. Well, when I said Black Friday, you could hear a pin drop, because Gloria Gaynor just arched her head, looked to me and goes, "Worked on what?" And I said, "Black Friday." And she looked at me and said, "Black Friday? Why do they call it Black Friday? Why has it got to be black?" I almost died. Because as a kid, all those years working and calling it Black Friday and Black Friday sales, I never knew the answer to that question. And I was like, you know, Ralph Crampton and the Honeymoon, humna, 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 humna. I didn't know how to answer. And I said, well, I said, "Miss Gaynor, I mean, it's nothing racist or anything. It's just that that's the name. I still want to know why it's called Black Friday and not White Friday or Red Friday or Green Friday." And I didn't have the damn answer. That was unbelievable. So I stammered and dug myself into a deeper hole and assured her there was no racist element to it whatsoever. I just thought everybody in the world knew what Black Friday, it's what it was called. I don't know. So it's always a funny memory to me when we come out of this week of these Black Friday sales and I think of Gloria Gaynor, you know, kind of calling me a racist and not really, but, you know, kind of those overtones of using the term Black Friday. Now, for those of you that don't know what Black Friday means and why it's called that, you bet your ass right after we shot that show, I found out from my friends who own stores immediately, why is it called Black Friday? And the answer is, as it turns out, because it's the day that stores go from the red, meaning they've lost money for the year, to the black, meaning they're in the black and they are profitable. I wish I knew that around 06 when I was sitting next to Gloria Gaynor. And, you know, every year you hear those stats, well, the sales are down a little bit. Well, of course they're down. You've extended the season of these sales and these door busters, telling people to bust a door down practically for like, it used to be 4 weeks. Now the whole thing's like 3 months. Of course it's not going to be as intense on that one weekend anymore. So anyway, to anybody that works retail, shout out to you guys. I'm thinking of you around this time of year and the incredible insanity you guys deal with because I was there. I worked retail for many years in a record store, and what goes on around this time of year, unfortunately not in record stores because there's not that many left, but what goes on this time of year is just madness. Thankfully, I don't work retail anymore, and I'm sitting here on this side of the microphone getting ready to bring you another interview for this week's Eddie Trunk podcast. Before we get to that, a couple announcements about upcoming appearances. If you're in New Jersey, December 19th, myself, Don, and Jim, we host a Christmas party every year at a great little club in Clifton, New Jersey called Dingbats. We just host some bands play. We have a great time there. We'll be doing that again December 19th. Also, sooner than that, if you're in Austin, Texas, or Houston, Texas, I'm coming to you. December 12th, I'm going to be at the Original Emos in Austin, Texas. From what I understand, that is a venue that has been closed, but they're reopening it that night. Broken Teeth and More are going to be performing. I'll be there as well, doing a little Q&A and having some fun with you guys on stage. So, man, I haven't been to Austin, Texas since I got drunk there with Ace Frehley in like 1987. So I'm looking forward to being back in Austin. December 12th, the Original Emos come and see me. And then the next night, December 13th, I'm back at Concert Pub North in Houston, Texas. Did Concert Pub North about, about a year ago. Tremendous time there. Tremendous turnout. Tremendous support. Thank you, guys, and hope to see you again on the 13th of December. Couple last holiday appearances. Also, I'm going to be hosting Y&T on New Year's Eve in San Jose, California at Rock Bar. So three more appearances between now and the end of the year. As always, go to eddietrunk.com, my website. Right on the homepage, all my confirmed appearances are right there. Hope to see you out at some of them. While you're on my site, Music News, you can email me through the site. And also, check my blog, which is The Trunk Report. Tell you everything that's going on. I'll post the info about that metal show in there. New episodes coming back February 21st. Information on guests and audience tickets will be in The Trunk Report on eddietrunk.com when I have them. You can also email me questions, eddie@eddietrunk.com, or hit the Contact Us tab on the site. Finally, thank you to everybody who has ordered personalized signed copies of either of my books, Volume 1 or 2 of Essential Hard Rock and Heavy Metal. Get those signed and personalized however you want directly from me. Hit the Books tab on my site. If you'd like unsigned copies, you can buy them anywhere books are sold. Also, Eddie Trunk, Trunk Nation shirts, hats, and more available in the merch store. Just hit the merch store on eddietrunk.com. That is the hub for everything. And if you want to get a book in time for the holidays as a gift, I'd get on it ASAP so I can sign them, turn them around, and get them out to you so you can give them for gifts however you'd like. Again, just hit books on eddietrunk.com. Got a great interview with you, for you, that was recorded for my radio show about a week and a half ago with David Coverdale coming up in a matter of minutes. Had great response to this. A lot of people wanted to listened to this and enjoyed hearing from David Coverdale, who is in great spirits. David has become a good friend over the years, and I'm very excited to talk to him this time around because he's promoting a DVD CD from 1984, which is really one of the only live documents and periods of time that John Sykes was in Whitesnake. I'm a huge fan of Sykes, and the 84 Whitesnake lineup with Cozy Powell and Neil Murray and John Sykes, one of my favorites by far in Whitesnake history. So it's cool that there's this document, which we'll discuss out there now. Unfortunately, Sykes would make the 87 record, but that band would never do a live show as the two had a big falling out. But Coverdale is now in his mid-60s, and he's just kind of the guy. He has fun. He gets along with everybody. He wants to mend every bridge. In the interview you're about to hear, he talks about connecting with Ritchie Blackmore again, Jimmy Page again. Of course, there was that Coverdale Page record. So we get into all sorts of stuff with David Coverdale, who is always so entertaining, as he is in the interview you are about to hear in a couple minutes. Next week, Dave Lombardo, podcast exclusive interview with me. You do not want to miss that. The former drummer of Slayer. Also coming up, Bob Rock, producer extraordinaire. And also before the end of the year, I think I'm going to do a top 10 of my favorite albums of 2014. Can't play the music on the podcast, but I'll give the list and talk about those titles. Maybe we'll do one of those before the year is up as well. As always, on my site, I do also announce and talk about the upcoming podcast guests and things like that. So as always, Twitter at Eddie Trunk, Facebook /Eddie Trunk, eddietrunk.com are the many ways to connect social media wise. But I think you guys will enjoy hearing from Coverdale and some of the things he has to say. He's always, like I said, very entertaining. And he has a new guitar player in the current version of Whitesnake with Joel Hoekstra, who I had a hand in helping him get. It's pretty amazing at this point in my career to have major artists like this reach out to me when they're looking for advice and people to join their bands. And that's exactly what David did, and helped him as best I could behind the scenes. And Joel Hoekstra, formerly of Night Ranger, is his new guitar player. And they're about to announce some big plans and their next release very, very soon. So you'll hear from David Coverdale on that and so much more in a matter of seconds. Now, speaking of shopping, I just got done telling you about how nuts it is in the stores. Traffic, fighting people who take the term door buster literally. I mean, you see those clips on the news. It's insane. Why would anybody want to do that? Especially when, for the holiday season, you got Amazon.com, and it's the best place to go for all your shopping needs. Even both of my books available from Amazon at a great price. Amazon.com helps support the podcast, mine, the one you're listening to, by keeping it free by offering my show a small commission on the products you purchase. So the next time you purchase something from Amazon, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com. Click on the Keep It Free banner. That's located on the top of the homepage. Then click on my show's banner. You'll find Amazon as well as all my other sponsors that help support this program. You can even use my Amazon banner if you're located in Canada or the UK. Also, to make it easier for all future purchases, feel free to bookmark my Amazon URL. You know the deal. Go to podcastone.com. Click on the Keep It Free banner to support Amazon. And all my great sponsors, won't cost you a penny more to buy that way, but helps keep this show possible and free.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
TrueCar is changing car buying forever. TrueCar helps car buyers get rid of the fear that they might overpay. Just in the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network, and TrueCar users save an average of $3,221 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com to find out what others paid for the car you want. Then register to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. To see how much you can save on the car you want, simply download the TrueCar mobile app or visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Listen to who Sean and Larry King are interviewing.
Martin Short has joined us.
How are you?
Jacqueline Lorita, one of the original cast members of The Real Housewives of New Jersey. John Voight.
Yay!
Hi, kid.
Damon John. He's become a major television star on Shark Tank. Carl Reiner.
I think I'm glad to be here. We'll find out at the end of the evening.
Every Thursday, Sean and Larry King interview Hollywood royalty, reality stars, and new up-and-comers.
Back
and forth
with
Sean
and
Larry
King
at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.
It's nothing but love when it comes to this man that's joining us on the phone line. It is Mr. David Coverdale. How are you, sir?
Edward Von Trunk, as I live and breathe. Doing very, 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 very handsomely. Thank you very much, Edward. And yourself?
Very good, thank you. Has love indeed set you free, David?
Are you kidding me? Every part of me. I have bluebirds flying out of every orifice.
Oh, man. Well, we're going to talk about a couple of things here, my friend. And one of them is, speaking of love, I got to tell you,
darling.
I saw this. I was so excited by this collection that recently came out. Whitesnake, Live in 84, Back to the Bone, DVD and CD. I've been playing it, watching it, talking about it. Amazing it was 30 years ago already.
It's astonishing, isn't it? Just amazing. Blows my mind.
This was, for me, an incredibly powerful lineup of Whitesnake. Not that...
Oh, yeah.
Not that there have been any bad ones, but this one was very special to me. You've got the incredible late, great Cozy Powell on drums. The very young, still wet behind the ears, John Sykes, at the time you had him. And Neil Murray on bass. And then you've got some stuff on here with the late, great John Lord as well.
Oh, my heart, yeah.
How to bring back some great memories revisiting this, huh?
You know, when I went into to rehearse in L.A. last year for the tour, whatever it was. Was it Year of the Snake? I don't know, one of them. It's all a blur after 40-something years. But I usually work at a place. I've been there for, 30 years, going back to it, a place in the Valley. And I was talking to the owner of the place and going, can you believe next year's the 30th anniversary of the Slided In album? He said, remember when you came in here with Sykes and Cozy and Neil? I said, yeah. He said, it was like an express train coming through my office wall. He said, I'd never heard anything like it before, and I've never heard anything like it since. It was. It was an extraordinary time, a beautiful, a really gifted band.
You know, it's incredible when you think about Slide It In and that period, because in a lot of ways, it was really the first. Now, I know that with Whitesnake, you had a tremendous amount of success with the band in Europe prior to breaking in America. But for me, here in the U.S., I think Slide It In was really the record that started to really put Whitesnake on a lot of people's radar. Would you agree with that?
Yes, totally. Radio took a shine to us immediately, you know, remembering, as I know you do, that Geffen kind of forced me to remix and make my albums more FM-friendly than the European approach that we'd taken. The European mixes just didn't fly on amazing FM radio, and that was a huge beginning. Radio loved it way before MTV. I think, you know, we sold over 600,000 records in the first 6 months. It was really the foundation for 87. And of course, then we had MTV to assist.
Now, it's an interesting thing about Slide It In, David, because being a big rock fan, even 30 years ago as a kid, I got this record. I used to get records from bands I liked before they came out in the U.S., and I would get it on import. So I remember getting I still have it, the Japanese import on CD of Slide It In. And then a few months later, it was released on Geffen in the U.S. with the guitars overdubbed of Sykes, who had joined the band. Talk about how all that happened. I mean, you had made this record, and you talk about it in the liner notes on the package, but you had made this record really with a completely different band and then kind of changed gears in a lot of ways, right?
Well, not completely different. We had a different bass player, and the original guitar player, Mickey Moody, was in the band. And a guy from Trapeze used to work with Glenn called Mel Galley. And, you know, we went in. John Lord was involved at that time. It was fantastic. But Geffen, you know, as you know, Whitesnake's like a book, you know, chapters finish and new chapters begin, a series, for God's sake. And they said, you know, we want to remix. And I said, well, if you want to remix, this is the deal. I want my new guitar player, John Sykes, and the return of the fabulous Neil Murray to overdub, you know, because they come back in after I'd finished the original album. And that was the reason I agreed to let them remix.
So the other guitars were wiped. Sykes was put onto the record. And then that's the version that is in the U.S. And I know that I think there was a special edition of Slide It In that I think both discs are in there, right?
Oh, yeah. Both the European mix and the U.S. mix for the first time was in the 25th anniversary. Dear God, was that 5 years ago? But yeah, I look upon this, by the way, the Back to the Bone, Live in 84, as a kind of an addendum, not a pudendum, an addendum or an appendix to the Slide It In record. You know, it just accompanies the studio album amazingly. That was the whole purpose behind it, just to celebrate what a great band it was. You know, we searched high and low for footage. We failed miserably after negotiating for years with the Rock and Rio people down in South America, just failed miserably every time we tried to say, look, it deserves to be out there. You know, it's pretty much the same show as the Japanese show on Live in 84, but they were impossible. I would have loved to have had the three shows on the DVD, but we just couldn't do it until I went, enough already. It's too distracting.
What was the problem? It was a legality issue? They owned it? They wanted
they said, you know, we want to mix it, you know, and I'm going, no, you don't understand. I'm a control freak. I mixed it, you know, and, you know, not a chance. It was just impossible. There was no logic. You know, I had several lawyers and I spent a lot of money trying to negotiate the stuff out, and everybody kept passing the buck. It was literally, you know, my co-producer, Michael McIntyre, and I just looked at each other and went, we have to let this go. It's never, you know, enjoy the bootlegs, you know.
Yeah, you know, because I know that was a special show for you in Brazil, because I remember about a year and a half ago. About a year and a half ago, I hosted a festival that you played in Brazil. And we were talking backstage, and you said to me that that was one of the first shows with Sykes, and you mentioned that it was this big thing for you guys at the time. And I don't think I've ever seen that footage. It's floating around on bootleg.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was broadcast live on El Globo. Yeah, it's out there. But, you know, just utterly impossible to, you know, we had to let it go. I refused to, if it's impossible to negotiate with somebody, you have to let it go. And this was for years, like 10 years we've been trying to get
this. Wow.
But, and then they owned up at the end. A lot of the analog tapes had deteriorated. So it was like we didn't even know what they had. So sadly, we had to move ahead without it, which is disappointing. But the story behind our appearance at Rock and Rio, it was an incredibly ambitious 10-day festival that we opened and closed. Queen, who was immense in that country, and what happened was the tragedy of Rick Allen losing his arm in that car accident from Def Leppard. Def Leppard was supposed to be there, and of course, after that tragedy. We share the same agent, as we still do, and he said, you know, do you want to go down to South America? I went, does a bear sit in my living room? Yes, you know. So we went down, and Sykes got guitarist of the festival, and I got vocalist and, excuse me, sex object.
Wow, beautiful.
Oh, indeed. No, it was really memorable. You know, it was. In fact, I was in L.A. the other week, and my tour manager from the time, you may have come across a guy called Jimmy Ayres. He worked with Aerosmith for many years. Jimmy was pistol whipped by the secret police on the side of the stage. Because, you know, I don't like people on the side, because nobody, if they distract the audience from what's going on stage. And Jimmy was trying to move these people back who actually drew guns and pistol whipped him. It was on the front page of the Rio paper.
Wow.
Pretty interesting times.
Let me ask you, David, and we're talking with David Coverdale, Whitesnake Live in 84, Back to the Bone, this incredible deluxe edition is what we're talking about. And I want to ask you about the band members in particular that make this incredible lineup up. How did they come on your radar? How did you at the time end up enlisting them in Whitesnake? Neil, Cozy, and John. First thing. How did they all come on your radar to work with them, and how did it come together?
Okay, well, Neil, of course, was a friend of Bernie Marsden's, one of the original guitar players with Whitesnake. And we were rehearsing and auditioning rhythm sections, Mickey Moody, Bernie, and I, in London, way back in the day, 78, whatever the hell it was, 77, 78, not sure. And, you know, we had a succession of punk bass players with safety pins through nostrils and smelling of Vaseline and all kinds of stuff, with a bass like hung down like twice as far as Pagey swings his Les Paul. But they looked amazing, but they could only play in E. You know, very great, but of course I like an assortment of keys. So Bernie turned around and said, there's a friend of mine who used to work with Cozy Powell's Hammer. He's around the corner. Shall I ask him to come over? I said, sure. So Neil came in, was playing beautifully, Eddie, but it just never occurred to me that he was a contender for the band. And then kind of one of the light goes on and you go, you know what? What the hell are we wasting our time for? Do you want the gig? And he was in. So Neil was in at the beginning. Cozy, of course, and I have been fans of each other for years. I'm a huge, huge Jeff Beck fan, all chapters. And that's when I first, you know, heard Cozy. And of course he worked with, my now dear friend Richie, and brilliantly too. But I actually hooked in to Cozy with the idea of bringing him into Whitesnake when he was with Michael Schenker.
As was Neil Murray. Neil Murray was with Schenker too before.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. That's why I was wondering what the connection was, because Neil Murray played.
No. I can't remember the guy. I know he's a great bass player. No, I don't think Neil was in there.
Chris Glenn was in too,
Chris
right?
Chris Glenn. That's who I'm thinking about. No, Neil. I don't think Neil was in Michael.
I thought he was for a second, but I could be confused.
Well, I might be on my way to a new Toyota if you keep this up.
That's but not in the budget, but.
But so yeah, well, actually, Cozy came over to actually talk me into if I would join Michael Schenker. And after evening of fun and frolics, he agreed to join me.
Wow.
And we had a fantastic chapter together. It was great. It was, you know, fabulous. It was lovely to work with Cozy. And, you know, things happen, things change, the dynamics change, as in any relationship. But, you know, there's no question at all. You know, I loved him. John, you know, I wanted to take Whitesnake to what I considered the next step, the next level. You know, I like a fresh coat of paint now and again, you know. And my agent, Rod McSween in London, I was sitting talking with him and he said, have you heard of John Sykes? And I can't remember if John was in Lizzie at that time or the Tigers of Pantang. It might have been Lizzie. And I said, okay, well, put Lizzie on my European tour. I went out and I did an early Monsters of Rock tour with Tim Lizzie guesting. And I thought John had amazing potential, which, of course, proved 1,000%, 1,000,000% right. And we talked several times about coming in. In fact, the drummer with Lizzie at that time, Brian, was saying, do it, Whip. It was very funny. And to be honest, it was really interesting. I flew John over to Munich where we were making the Slide It In album. And I was also at the same time talking to Adrian Vandenberg about coming in because, we'd already established a good connection. Michael Schenker. You know, it wasn't just like blonde guys I was looking for, but these were the three guitar players I was really impressed with. And John came over and played some stuff and had him jam to a 24 track or whatever. We went out, partied, and then he flew home. And I didn't really get much support from my colleagues at the time, but something inside me said, no, we're going to take, you know, take this guy, and thankfully it was right.
Yeah, it turned out to be an amazing band, and that was I mean, it's just really incredibly powerful. And what I find really interesting too about this collection, and for people that don't know the lineage of Whitesnake, there's people may be scratching their head and looking at a concert from 1984 and seeing Crying in the Rain on here and saying, mm-hmm. wait a minute, that was on the 87 record. How is it on a concert in 84? But the truth is that both Crying in the Rain and Here I Go Again were both
Here
on
I Go Again.
Saints
yes,
and
yeah,
Sinners,
yeah.
right?
Correct, absolutely correct. That didn't see the light other than on import in the United States at that time.
Right, so
it was what I always refer to as the contractual obligation album. The only way I got my freedom from my former management was to, you know, to down tools, as it were, which I recommend to anybody who's not happy with their circumstances. Down tools and say, I'm not going to pick them up again until you're reasonable, you know. And of course, nobody could finish the record. Nobody knew what the melodies or the lyrics were. So I ended up paying $1 million and getting my freedom, and Slide It In was my first album under my banner. You know,
but going back to Here I Go Again and Crying in the Rain, both became the, I mean, Here I Go Again, of course, it became an enormous hit song. Crying in the Rain, a huge album track from the 87 record. Both, you know, different performances, very different songs in their earlier versions. What I find interesting about the 84 live recording is where you do Crying in the Rain live is you could hear, with John being new to the band, him starting to put his interpretation on it live to what it would become when it was recorded by him a few years later.
Indeed. But I must salute Neil Murray, who assisted very much in that middle section. You know, the original version is more blues orientated over, you know, like an E drone. But Neil was an incredibly musical man. And he contributed huge to that middle section of Here I Go Again, the arrangement, you know. But both Here I Go Again and Crying in the Rain, I wrote at probably the same time within a very sad end of my first marriage holiday, a writing vacation in Portugal, you know. So you can see where I was at that time.
Yeah.
So both those songs, you know.
Yeah, no doubt. And you know what? I spoke to Adrian Vandenberg just a few weeks ago because he...
Oh, not the Moon King himself.
Yes. And you know what I didn't know, and this is just a side note, is the only guitar solo, I had often heard this, and I didn't know it was true until Adrian said it, but the only guitar solo on 87 that wasn't Sykes was the solo to Here I Go Again is Adrian Vandenberg on the record?
Absolutely correct, yeah.
I had no idea. I thought it was just on the remix, not on the actual album. How did that happen?
Edward, I would bitch slap you. Was I in the same room? How do you don't read your liner notes?
Never saw any other name on the liner notes. The back of that record just lists the four guys who are on it.
Oh, the cheapskates at Geffen. No. Well, it's certainly on the European version. Credit where credit's due. Everybody who makes a good cup of tea gets a credit on my record. But Adrian and I, you know, when we spoke originally during the Slide It In, if you remember, he was having a hit with a song called Burning Heart.
Sure.
With his own band, Vandenberg. And he said, this is the most difficult decision I've ever made. And I said, listen, I endorse you. You go run with the ball, mate, if this is going to be a hit, you know. And if we get the opportunity to work together, which, of course, we did, and for a very significant period of time. I think Red Beach has actually just passed Adrian Vandenberg's record of length of stay with me. But Adrian came over, and John was not really supportive of the idea of Here I Go Again. And his solo, it just wasn't up to what he did on the other songs. So Keith Olsen and I said, well, you know, why don't we try Adrian, see how he takes to it? And he did a beautiful solo that everybody knows. And so, in fact, when Red plays the solo, he honors Adrian's melody, you know, completely.
Mm, interesting. And the other thing on... Back to
let me just finish off with Adrian Vandenberg. I said, we're driving over, and I was in the Jag, you know, playing tracks, and I'm going, can you get above me on this chorus, Here I Go Again? Can you, you sing, don't you? And you went, oh, yes, of course. And I went, oh, great. So you can sing above me? Because, you know, I'm singing pretty high. And he went, oh, are you kidding me? The primary, the chairman of Drunken Sailors. But, I mean, anyway, he's still got the gig, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, the other and the other component to this period, which, as I said, is represented in a few of the elements of this, is of course the late great John Lord. Talk about his involvement in the band at this period.
Well, I didn't think John would want to continue when I said I was bringing Cozy in, because he and Ian Paice pretty much lived next door to each other and are married to twins. You know, so I said, look, I'll fully understand if you want to call it a day. And he went, no, let's do it. But it was in that time period, of course, that the Deep Purple Mark II were looking at revamping. And for certain reasons, I said to John, really, John, I don't know how the future of Whitesnake is going to unfold, but I think it would serve you well. I said, Purple can't reform Mark II without you. You're a founder member. And I said, you know, please use my lawyer, anything, you know, to negotiate going back into that. And of course, they did amazingly well, and John did fabulously with them. That's his baby. Purple was, you know, Richie's and John's baby.
Sure.
You know, and I honor him totally and supported that transition completely. And I never really wanted to, talk about replacing musicians, but certainly John Lord was utterly irreplaceable.
And he's on this, there's a DVD, part of the, one of the DVD bonuses is John Lord's final performance with Whitesnake, which was in Vegas?
No. But I tell you, whenever I see, when I go, good evening, Las Vegas, that was like 10 a.m. in the morning in Stockholm in a hotel conference room for a TV show. Literally, at the time, I was going, no. We do extraordinarily well in Scandinavia, in Sweden, and great audiences. They've looked after me since Purple days. And right at the end of the Slided In European tour with John, EMI Sweden said, oh, look, this is the biggest show in Sweden, you've got to do it. And we'd be like at the end of the tour, so we were kind of ragged, if you know what I mean. But we were in the same hotel as they were hosting it, so it was kind of, oh, okay. So after no sleep, we went down to this TV thing, and I walk in and I go, what the hell are we playing at? You know, it was this mock cafe. That's why I go, good evening, Las Vegas. And the camera cuts to John, like this little smile, and immediately the tear ducts go on me, you know, immediately.
I thought you were in like a casino in Vegas or something.
It was a conference room, and I swear to God, thank the angels for saying, hey, do it. You know, in 30 years' time, you're going to be, thank God I have this record of the very last shows I did with John.
Yeah,
it's, you know, amazing. And you look at it, and I'll go, God, Eddie, you know, I talk about it in the liner notes of the Live in 84 project. 50% of the band that make the record has passed away. It's breathtakingly difficult to countenance. One of the primary thing that I watch on this project, and I watched it last night, is the slideshow. The Slided In slideshow. It's just so touching to go back. I'm transported. That's why I refer to it as a kind of time capsule. It's really incredibly fresh. You know, there's a thing where I've written this song called What Became Standing in the Shadows, which at that time was just a piece of music. And I had this awful rhythm box, a Hammond auto-vary drum machine that you would hear in every cheesy nightclub or bar. And Mel hits the wrong tempo, and I went, oh, Mel! And you hear the drum turn up to the right tempo. But yep. That stuff, I'm right back in the room with Mel, God bless him. You know, it's amazing for me.
Yeah, and I noticed that you said that you did the best you could to work with and restore this content as best it could, mm-hmm. because I know on the DVD, the first couple of songs, the keyboards are louder than the guitar. There's not a lot of guitar in the mix. It seems like there was some stuff going on there. So were there some challenges to try to get this to a point where you were happy with it?
Oh, my God. We spent 6 months. We worked with a fantastic guy, a mastering guy in Los Angeles called Dave Donnelly, and I've worked with him since the Geffen days. He was the quality control executive at Geffen, and now he runs a mastering room in Los Angeles. And we would be sending files down to him to tweak, and then we'd send it back into, you know, the mono mixes. I mean, this is literally, it's not a pristine remix thing. We've done everything we can to EQ. All of the music is demos or bootlegs, you know, that we tweaked and tweaked and tweaked to try to make them as listenable as possible. I kind of listen to them in the car. It's much raunchier.
You mentioned that in the liner notes that's your preferred way to hear it.
But yeah, there's the impossible thing is that, you know, you're in the hands of a TV company in Japan who, you know, and I'm going, well, how the hell can we get the frequencies of John's guitar louder? I mean, it's amazing. Totally
and you
amazing.
Didn't you didn't have the tracks, obviously, to mix, so
no,
you just had to deal with it.
24 tracks were destroyed decades ago. We searched everywhere. The whole idea of this project came from lunch with the owner of the Japanese record company we worked with. And he said, I'd love to do something with this. And I said, well, you got, I had a laser disc of it, you know?
Wow.
And I said, if you can find any, I said, I can guarantee, I'll make sure you get the project, you know? But it was a total labor of love trying to find all these elements, the stuff in there from photographs that have never been seen, demos of mine, you know, the first time I ever played, slide it in, you know, all or nothing. It's just amazing. It's a very, very touchy thing. But really, it's not a standalone project. It is to accompany the Slide It In album, you know.
Yeah, well,
and that time period, you know.
Yes, for sure. And I love the fact that it's real and it's raw and that it is what it is. I mean, and the packaging is fantastic too. The gatefold on the CD and DVD, it really is. It really is awesome.
The most important thing about it, Edward, for you being a fan of that particular chapter, and I know you've always been supportive of my work, but you can hear this, what an amazing band it was. And that was the first time I've worked with, not a single guitar player. It's the only time, because Mel had an accident and broke his arm. And we said, well, we have to continue. We had a tour book. You know, promoter in Europe was ready to lose his shirt if we canceled the tour. And it took months and months and months for Mel to get better. By that time, Sykes had totally risen to the occasion. Cozy was playing better than ever. And Neil was just, it was fucking amazing band.
Yeah, it is.
Fire.
It's to revisit it.
John was starting to sing too, which was amazing, you know, which ultimately led him to, you know, being a solo singer himself.
Yeah. I mean, to revisit this, I mean, there's so, you're right. I mean, of course, I've loved all the things that you've done right up to the present. I just played, you know, Love Will Set You Free. I mean, the Forevermore record.
I love that tune. I want Stevie Wonder to record it.
But that period of time was so, that band, I mean, I'm such a huge fan of Cozy's, such a huge fan of Sykes, and there's so little documentation of you live with John and with Cozy that it's so cool to have this, because of course when 87 rolled around you had the record with John, but the live shows weren't there because you had made the changes. So it's just so cool to have a document like this as a fan of that era.
Are you kidding? I mean, I see John and how beautiful, you know, he is. Amazing. You know, it was a really happening band.
Yeah.
You know, John was on fire. There was nobody around to touch John at that time. You know, and he, this was just the beginning of, it was like the launching pad for what became, you know, ultimately the 87 Sykes, which influenced a generation of guitar players, you know?
No question, no question.
Oh, the guitar, the pick slide,
the power slide or whatever he calls that, I forget, but.
It's totally, that's all it is. He owns that.
Yeah, it's pretty massive stuff. So, David, let me ask you overall, you have put out a lot of these sort of retrospectives of certain periods of your career in the last few years. I love them because I love having these professionally produced documents of certain periods. But it seems like you're maybe just because it's so much time has passed that you're hitting these landmarks, but you seem like you're at a point in your career where you're really enjoying this reflection back on your earlier days. Would that be
immensely
accurate?
Yeah. Absolutely accurate and immensely so. Yeah. I'm 63 years old now. I can't believe I'm blessed to be still creating music and having amazingly electrifying, talented musicians want to work with me. And creating new music all the time. I'm so honoring my past with the present, it's not even funny. There was a time that it just didn't feel right for me to look back. I can't, you know, I'm the worst reverser as a driver. I cannot reverse. You know, my wife insists that the next house we get has a circular driveway. So I don't have to take out jardiniers and whatever. But so going back has never worked for me. I'm a nostalgic guy for, you know, other people's work, but not necessarily mine. It's, you know, I haven't taken the time to go back and reflect on stuff. And of course, when it's so much more comfortable for me, and I can enjoy it without thinking of any bitterness or resentment for particular times. I choose to remember the colorful, more pleasant, and positive aspects of these times.
Yeah, we've talked, and of course we're friends, and we've talked privately, and you've expressed that to me, that you're at a point in your life where you just really embrace and celebrate all of it, and if there were issues or what have you back in the day, it's just you've just moved on, and you just want to feel good about everything and put it out there and remember.
Well, you know, you and I discussed, I think, in the last time I was honored to be your guest, about the loss of John, and in the same time frame, my wife lost her beloved brother, and then I lost my favorite Auntie Sylvia, who introduced me to as a 5, 6, 7 year old to Little Richard and Chuck Berry and all these things. She was a teenager spending all her pocket money on singles that I for some reason totally resonated with me and still do. And every conversation I had with her for over 50 years was all, you know, most of the conversation was music. You know, I'd send her stuff and, you know. But this period of time, losing three incredibly important and precious people in our lives, I thought, God, there's got to be something to learn from this. And you know, the epiphany that was just deadly simple was it's a waste of time, you know, holding on to bitterness, acrimony. That's the stuff that ages you, you know. So I got together a bunch of, you know, imaginative olive branches and started to reconnect with people. And thankfully, most people, including my incredibly gifted Richie Blackmore, you know, after 30 years of acrimony, you know, to be communicating again was just an extraordinary gift. And to be able to thank him for the incredible opportunity the courage that Deep Purple showed in taking this untried. You know, Glenn was kick-ass. He was kicking ass with trapeze. I never made a record.
It's an amazing story,
you know,
in and of itself.
Are you kidding me? I was 20 years old, man. I got the gig for my 21st birthday.
That's amazing.
Mind-blowing.
How did you connect with Blackmore again? When did you speak with Blackmore?
Well, you know, 'tis a small world, as Mr. Disney would remind us. We shared a driver in Europe, a guy called Sasha. And slowly but surely I'd say, oh, well, send my best to Richie and Candice. You know, expecting to look around and going, oh, I'm not going to say anything, you know. But he was also a really good Mac guy, and if I had issues with my laptop, he'd be in there fixing it. It's the only reason I cannot think that I have Candace Knight's email address. So I sat there, and I wrote a very respectful email introducing myself. Oh, listen, got a, who is this? How did you get this address? And then she, I'll get back to you. And then like a couple of days later, she said, oh, I'm so sorry. The next person you hear from will be Richie, you know. And we had a super reconnect. And, yeah, it was amazing. And it feels a hell of a lot better than having animosity, I assure you.
I mean, I'm sure it was just a hey, how you doing call, but do you envision?
Oh no! We had quite a few exchanges. Well, yeah,
Do you think there's any? You know, Jolyn Turner was on with me a week ago, and he's apparently had some back and forth there as well again, and he's looking at it as somewhat optimistic that maybe Richie's going to get back to playing some heavy rock again. Did you get that sense?
Well, one of the things that's really difficult for me globally, and particularly in Europe, is journalists asking me, when is Richie going to get back? I don't know. Look, when I first started to work and write most of the songs of Deep Purple Mark III with Richie, it was a scenario of we both loved English folk music, you know, that modal or whatever. You just turn the guitar up and it works. I mean, pretty much everything Richie and I wrote was some big muscular riff. You know, or modal music like Bach or old English folk music, and a total pleasure to do that. But you know, all I would say to him, look, I love what I'm doing, and I believe, and I know Richie loved Renaissance. I totally, you know, that old English folk music, and he found a beautiful woman who became his wife and the mother of his children. And they make amazing music together as Blackmore's Night. But I got to tell you, I have a feeling that he is going to get back into making some of those astonishing electric guitar things. And I wish him every success, because he's one of the originals, the originators, an incredibly influential musician.
Well, without question, and I know there's a lot of people working on him. Like I said, Joe was here last week, and he said something similar. And I mean, we can only hope. I mean, nobody's getting any younger, and it would be awesome to see him put that strat on again and play with somebody and fire up again.
Well, somebody told me that he does like the end of the Blackmore's Night show. But sadly, haven't seen it. But then he gets the strat out, and of course everybody goes, ooh. You know, I remember when I worked with Pagey and the Les Paul case came into my house, and everybody's standing around as the case is opened, and everybody sees number one and goes, ooh. Totally, you know, the white strat, come on, are you kidding me? No, Richie's I would stand behind his amps and stuff and listen, just be mind blown at the guitar playing.
Hey, you hooked up with your old friend Jimmy Page recently, huh?
Oh my God, I'm lucky I didn't do a stint in rehab. Are you kidding? Yeah, I was stopped for speeding coming home from Los Angeles outside of on the Mojave Desert, and this cop, and I said, I'm so terribly sorry. I sounded like Jack Sparrow, you know, and he went and gave me my details back and let it continue. But I spent a week on intravenous Chardonnay in Los Angeles. I went down to celebrate, have dinner with Jimmy, and celebrate his book, which is, you know, in front of me actually, with beautiful sentiments in there. I love Pagey so much, and it's like Richie. I'm there for him if he needs me for a song. I'm there for Jimmy if he needs me for a song. You know, I love what I'm doing, Edward. You know that, and I love the people I'm doing it with. And I just wish these guys such success, you know, because they will enthrall people. Jimmy's, you know, looking at doing some stuff. He said to me he's got the last section of the collection of the Zeppelin catalog to be remastered. And he said, then he's going to get onto his music. And I said, I'm so excited for you. You know, it was an amazing night, though. Joey Walsh was there, Joe Perry. Ringo, for God's sakes. Are you kidding? It was a great dinner.
Wow, what a fly on the wall that must have been to be for jeez.
And I was chatting. I tell you, one of my favorite American bands is Black Crowes. It's heartbreaking that that they are no more, but I know what internal friction can do. and how challenging it can be. But I was talking a lot with Steve Gorman, super guy. I had no idea that Black Crowes were total anglophiles into like Blackadder and Monty Python, and all he's doing is firing all these jokes, and I had to get the dust off the old mental Rolodex to compete. You know?
Wow, amazing. I mean, maybe Page calls you to do a little something on this project he's going to do, huh?
Well, listen to you, like I need a blind date. Come on.
You know what? I always wondered, when you did the Coverdale Page record, how did your name come first? Did you have to fight for that?
No, alphabetical.
Oh!
I've got to tell you, it infuriated our mutual lawyers because they thought they were going to make a mint. You know, we sat down in the Plaza in New York, and I said, let's just do everything 50-50. He went, okay.
I would think the biggest fight would be whose name comes first, and I didn't think of the alphabetical angle.
I tell you, Jimmy and I, there's a super bond, and I can't tell you how blessed I am to have a friendship with such an amazing guy, you know, with such a legacy, dear God. Yeah. But I got to tell you, the other highlight for me in Los Angeles, I don't know whether you've ever had him on your show, but you really ought to. An astonishing guy. I'm standing at the bar, you know, I look like three Elizabeth Taylors when I go down to L.A., you know, it's like boxed sea, like I'm going on a six-month sea voyage. So the poor old bastard's unpacking me and stuff, and I'm at the bar quaffing wine and holding court, and this guy came over and he goes, David, I just wanted to say hello, you know, I'm a huge fan. I went, oh, thank you so much, and I said, I'm David Cavalier. He said, oh, I'm Shep Gordon.
Uh-huh.
You know, Supermensch. Are you kidding? What a beautiful guy. And we ended up hanging out for like 5 days, having breakfast and stuff. Beautiful man. You know, I was with him before he went to the American Film Awards, where Johnny introduced him in a Captain Jack Sparrow introduced him, you know.
Yeah, documentary. There's a documentary about Shep's.
Supermensch. It's a great, great, great documentary. Mike Myers, you know, SNL alumni, and Wayne's World, written more comedic catchphrases than anybody in history. He has honored Shep with this amazing and totally deserving video, and it won Best Documentary, and I'll certainly be voting for it in the BAFTAs. Beautiful guy, man. You know, and 43 years. The only person he manages now is Alice Cooper. They've been together, or pretty much family, for 43 years, Edward.
That's amazing. I don't think there's ever been a manager-artist relationship that long.
Oh, it's gonna be the longest. God. You know, but what a super guy. You know, and no negatives.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, no diving into the bushes to avoid a confrontation, you know.
Hey, David, yeah. last thing before I let you go, let's get an update on what you're doing now. You've got, Joel Hoekstra on board now. What's the plan?
Oh, yeah. I've got to tell you, a thousand thanks to you for your help, too. You know, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, Edward is a walking Rolodex of musicians and their stories, and was invaluable in guiding and counseling, you know, looking for a new guitar player for Whitesnake. And Joel, you know, you can testify, came with six shiny stars of approval in every aspect of his life. But Jesus Christ, what a player. He's incendiary. Amazing musician. Truly, truly is inspiring. And a beautiful guy, too. We pretty much, you know, he was the only guy. We didn't audition him. We just flew him in. He jammed. I went, you want it? You're in. You know, it was that simple.
Well, I appreciate you thinking enough of me to ask me for some feedback. And I knew that it was working out well before it was announced when I got a text message of the two of you smiling from him. And I said, I guess they're hitting it off. So.
Yeah. We just had to keep it quiet out of respect for, you know, for his colleagues in his former band. And I respected that till the point where it was just starting to get out. And I said, you know, you want some front page on this, Jay, you know, we got to pull the trigger, you know.
Right.
But right now, for instance, I'll give you a clue of today. You know, we've been editing videos. We shot 4 videos for the new project. And, you know, so I'm going from the video edit room at Hook City, and then we discovered we were missing some guitar fills. You know, we completely blanked on guitar fills for one song. So I called Joel. I said, are you busy with the TSO? And he went, are you kidding? 7 shows in 3 minutes, you know, 3 days or something. And I said, okay, well, I need you to do some guitar fills on this tune. Here's the file. And he did it, man. Just amazing. So we were doing that. And once you and I are done, I'm recording my son for the new album. So it's just a totally full and fulfilling day.
Wow, that's amazing that you've got so much good stuff going on. So when?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're looking at most likely starting the world tour in the U.S. Probably May, June next year, and we're looking at album release will be probably end of March or early April.
And when? You know? And I know there's only certain things you can and can't say right now, but when will you be able to announce details about what this album will be?
Oh, God. Well, actually, I'm putting together a little, not a press release, but something that the record company we work with in Italy have all their labor managers coming in for the an end of the party and a presentation of what's coming. So I'm going to send this stuff in, and hopefully it doesn't burst wide open, because you know me, I love surprises. I don't want to know what the wife's got me for Christmas. I want to go, oh, Uggs, you know. Metallica studied Uggs. Thank you. You know,
the question I have for you, David, is your household like mine? When you get a gift, it's wonderful to see, and then a month later, you see the gift turn up on your own credit card statement that you have to pay.
Well, that's without saying. It's not even you know. So you know, my wife will turn around and say, "Oh, you bought me this." I went, "Oh, thank you."
Exactly.
Yeah,
I said, "I don't want anything because I don't want to see the charge on the bill I have to pay."
I love you know. The same as you. I'm much more of a giver than a receiver. Not sexually, of course, but in terms of Christmas presents. But for me, it's just a blessing to have such an amazing family. And seeing my son grow and like the whole new chapter with him is, oh my God, I'm getting UPS at this time of the night.
How old is your son? How old is your son now?
He's 18 and is going to be an actor. And I look forward to voting for him in BAFTAs. I swear to God, he's a beauty. We're insanely proud of him. I saw him. Well, I was supposed to be getting an award at the recent Classic Rock Awards in L.A., mm-hmm. and it conflicted with my son's performance, and I have no regrets on passing on the award and being unable to attend the Classic Rock Awards. As much as I love those guys, I just couldn't do it. You know, my primary concern is my family.
As it should be, absolutely. Hey, the last thing, and then I'm going to let you go because I appreciate all the time. We hear all these stories about, you know, I have so No.
Okay, well, what stories?
Stories from, I hear from so many bands that come on this show because as we all get older, people say, oh, this may be the end. This may be the last record. This is the farewell tour. This is this. You know, I may end it after this. Where are you at with all that? How much time do you think you have left as a performer?
I haven't the slightest idea. The person you should have asked at 30 years old who was inconsolable. Drunk on White Port and 7-Up in Portugal as I came to my 30th birthday 33 years ago, but I thought it was all over then. When I left Deep Purple, I thought it was all over then. I thought I'd be buying a pub and, you know, telling salty stories to people. I have no idea, dude.
So
I'm catching these waves and I'm going to ride them until people turn around and go, you know what? It's time to stop.
So as far as recording and going out on tour and all that, even after all these decades, it's still something that you're excited about, that you enjoy, that you love doing.
Are you kidding? I wouldn't do it. I'd stay home and learn how to fish.
Well, you're doing it for the right reasons because you love it, man.
No,
that's awesome.
I totally love it. And unfortunately, I'm blessed with the fact that I have amazing players. I have an amazing support, fans across the world. you know, wherever we start, you know, we'll be finishing in either York to somebody else's country. It's amazing. Whitesnake tours the world, and next year we're going to be doing some very special shows with some very dear friends of ours. So it's going to be a fabulous year. You know, I can't wait. You know what I'm doing. I've shared with you. It's so exciting. But I can't tell you. Wait till you hear this stuff.
Well, it's not. I know what you're doing, but it's not up to me to say that. So when you
no. But it's all. It's incredible. It's epic. I'm walking out there going, you kidding? This is the band have just shone. You know, Tommy Aldridge has played like a 19-year-old punk. You know, with just amazing energy. It's impossible for me not to respond.
Well,
you know,
when you're ready...
shooting four videos with these guys within the week, I was like, I'm the last person who wants to do a video. And I went, Jesus, this is so much fun. And the energy, just because we were actually playing, you know, to the soundtrack of the video. But the intensity was amazing. Blew the director and the team away. It was amazing. Look at me, very excited.
Well, when you're ready to reveal that, of course, we'll have you on again, and we'll get into all those details about what you're working on right now. But,
oh, yeah, baby.
It's always a pleasure, my friend, to spend some time, and I appreciate it. Whitesnake Live in 84, Back to the Bone is what you can get now, CD and DVD, Coverdale Sykes, Cozy Powell, Neil Murray, just a monster of a band 30 years ago. You got and some John Lord stuff on there, too. It's absolutely brilliant. Listen, best to your family, David, and thank you for the time.
On to yours. You got it.
Take care. We'll see you soon, DC.
You got it, brother. God bless. Always a treat.
Thank you, man. All right. Thank you very much, David Coverdale, my guest on this week's Eddie Trunk podcast. The Eddie Trunk podcast is produced by Katie Irizarry. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're new every Thursday, so be sure to subscribe on iTunes, download and listen on iTunes or at podcastone.com. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Download new episodes every week at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.